today, I'm honored to introduce Ed Wolpert. Today's topic that he's going to speak on is entitled Israel 2018, It's Complicated. Dr. Wolpert started his teaching career in New York City in 1962. He received a doctorate in education for the University of Kansas in 1970, and he spent 13 years at Ball State University in Indiana as a professor and as a chairman of elementary education. He came to Georgia College in 1983 as dean and held that position for another 13 years, at which time he returned to teaching graduate courses until his retirement in 2000. In 1997, he received a Bachelor's of Arts degree in French from Georgia College and State University, and he presents himself as an alumnus of Georgia College and State University and a professor, as well as a Dean Emeritus. He is most proud, though, of his role in the development of the field-based undergraduate cohort programs and the field-based Master of Arts in Teaching program. Ed is now semi-retired and lives in Blue Ridge, where he provides personal financial advising for a variety of clients and also writes extensively on that topic. He enjoys playing the euphonium with the Young Harris Community Band and other civic endeavors. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you for that kind introduction. I wrote it myself. She didn't have any choice. I was very brilliant. Okay, Israel in 2018, it's complicated. I first went to Israel in 1981. It was just kind of a tourist kind of thing. Then I was there about 5 years ago, and then I went last May. And so Israel in 2018, what I'm telling you is based on what I learned a few months ago. And the subtitle, It's Complicated, I put that there because when I was in Israel this last time, you ask any question. How do the Arabs and the Israelis do this, or what do the ultra-Orthodox say about this? Whatever question you ask, the first thing a person will say is, it's complicated. Everything is complicated in Israel, and we're talking about a country that exists as one democracy surrounded by autocracies, in a region of the world that has never is a long time. It hasn't had peace for a long time. It's a meeting of East and West, and lots of cultural differences and all. So that's part of the complication. First, I have to make a disclaimer. I'm not a historian. I'm not a scholar. I'm not an Israeli citizen. I'm Jewish, secular Jewish. I consider myself to be open-minded and fair, but the views that I'm expressing here are mine and not dictated by the American Jewish Congress or the Palestine Liberation Organization. I mean, they're my views. And I've organized my comments around three areas of conflict. The first is the ultra-Orthodox versus everybody else in Israel. They are small, but they are powerful. And we'll deal with that in some detail. The second conflict is between the Israeli Jews and the Israeli Arabs. That's one of the ones that's getting better, I'm happy to say. The third is the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That's bad. It's not getting any better. And that's going to be a major problem for eternity, I think, because there are no easy answers to that. Okay, so let's look at the first conflict. Okay, this is a breakdown of the Jews in Israel. The first category is the Haredim. If you have trouble with the Haredim, you can say Haredim. It's okay. It's like Hanukkah and Hanukkah, you know. If you don't start saying that CH sound when you're young, you're never going to get it. So call it what you like. So the Haredim, and these are the ultra Orthodox. And then there are and that's only 8% of the population, of the Jewish population. Then there are the religious Orthodox, sometimes called modern Orthodox, 12%. Israeli, what we would call conservative. And then there's religious, a non-traditionalist, that would be probably close to Reform. And then there's the secular. 43% are considered themselves secular Jews, like me. And half of them believe in God. So this gives you an idea of the composition of the country. These data are from the Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics, a 2010 study, I've simplified it to for this presentation. So let's look at the ultra-Orthodox. Okay, you'll know one when you see one. By their appearance, the men wear black pants and black jackets, white shirts, button at the top, no tie. Women dress very, very modestly, showing very little skin. Certainly nothing above the elbow and nothing above the knee, and not too much here either. So it's quite modest, not quite as severe as the Muslims with their burqa, but it's you don't show much flesh. We'll get to that in a little bit. They look as if they were in the 18th century in Poland. Exactly the same. It's like you walked into a different world. They speak, for the most part, Yiddish. Some Hebrew, but mostly Yiddish. That's the vernacular. Many of the ultra-Orthodox believe that Hebrew, the language, is reserved for prayer. They are very religious. There are 613 commandments in Leviticus, telling what you need to do and think if you want to be Jewish. Some of them are probably known to you, the idea of kosher food. Another one that's kind of interesting is you're not supposed to wear clothing made of fabrics of two different sources, like wool and linen, you know. I don't understand the reasons for this, but they follow every one of them. Another thing about the ultra-Orthodox is they are non-Zionist. Now, Zionism, in contrast to Judaism, Zionism is a political movement, and it was started, and we'll get to this in some detail later on, in the late 19th century, and the idea of Zion is the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, or Palestine, if you will. The ultra-Orthodox don't believe in this. They're kind of there under duress. They don't believe in Zionism. They think the Messiah is coming, but not for a while. So they are non-Zionists. The education that they provide, first, boys and girls are separate, and boys and girls are not supposed to intermingle except if they're in the same family, okay? The education they get is emphasizes religious studies, and generally the education goes to the 12th grade. At that time, girls are supposed to marry and have children. Boys are supposed to marry them and study the Torah, and that's what they do. The problem with this is that you get an 18-year-old young woman and starts having children at that age, and because of the way Orthodox Jews interpret the Bible, be fruitful and multiply. It's interesting that God never mentioned the factor by which you multiply. But they have they have rules of a lot of rules dealing with sex. And the Orthodox Jews, when a woman begins her menstrual period, she is considered unclean and remains so for at least 7 days, and then probably another 7 days. And so you have a woman who is not eligible to have sex until about 15 days after the beginning of her menstrual cycle, at which time, as most of you know, is a very fertile time. So you get two young people, they're married, and you know, you get kind of horny, you know, after 2 weeks, and so it's no surprise that they have children. Families of 10 children, 12, 14, are not uncommon. I mean, just do the arithmetic. Start at 18, have a baby every year, just about. A problem with the education of the boys is that they study the Torah and the Talmud. That's fine, you know, but they don't have a secular curriculum. And so they are undereducated, which makes them unemployable. And so you have, you know, large families, no marketable skills, and this leads to poverty. And there's a lot of poverty. So where do they get their money? There's support from the government, and there is charitable contributions, mostly from Jews in the rest of the world. They engage in a very strict gender segregation. Women are, by any standard, second-class citizens. Got to sit at the back of the bus during services. These are the ultra-Orthodox I'm talking about. During religious services, the men are on one side, the women on the other side. There is a physical barrier between them. No touching. Jews love to dance. The ultra-Orthodox love to dance. But men only dance with men, and women only dance with women. And men are encouraged to avoid contact with women unless they're part of the family or they're married. And there's a story that one of the presenters on our tour told about an Orthodox Jew who was on a plane, and he went to his assigned seat and was next to a woman. Oh, well, he didn't want to sit next to a woman because he wasn't supposed to, unless it's his wife. And so the flight attendant arranged for him to sit somewhere else. And this kind of stuff happens all the time. And why do you stay away from women? Well, first of all, there could be sexual arousal, and sexual arousal with somebody that's not your wife is verboten. You know, you just don't do that. And the other thing, which I find interesting, is that a woman who is menstruating is considered unclean. You're supposed to stay away from her and not touch her, not even go near her. And the reason for this is that she is impure, and if you go near a person that is impure, some of the impurity might get into you. It's like menstruation is contagious, you know. And I don't think it is, or at least I've never caught it. The ultra-Orthodox generally have not served in the military. This is changing somewhat because a lot of the Israeli, the non-Hasidic, non-Chavarim Jews are a little resentful because they're getting money, they're not working, and they don't serve in the military. But that's changing. Okay, so this is the ultra-Orthodox. There's what, 8% of the population, but they swing a lot of power. They unite politically. If they were to walk out on a government, the government might fall. So Netanyahu and his predecessors have to be very, very careful not to offend them. And so when progress is sought on many of these issues, they have to fight the ultra-Orthodox. So, This trip that I went on is sponsored by ARZA. ARZA stands for Association of Reform Zionists of America. Okay, and it's a lot of rabbis who want to introduce Reform Judaism to Israel. There are not that many Reform Jews in Israel, but there are a lot of secular and Jews. And the idea is to provide to Jewish citizens, especially young ones, an alternative to ultra-Orthodox, because the ultra-Orthodox kind of have a monopoly on everything about marriages and divorces and other civil issues. And so I found a definition of Reform Judaism. You know, for me, Reform Judaism has always symbolized what I would consider the best of Judaism, firmly rooted in our tradition, yet egalitarian, inclusive of patrilineal Jews. You know, if you're born to a Jewish mother, you're Jewish, whether you want to be or not. If you're not born to a Jewish mother, according to the ultra-Orthodox, you're not Jewish. And so, but you could have a Jewish father. And so they want to include patrilineal Jews as well as matrilineal Jews and intermarried families, which the ultra-Orthodox don't care for. They're welcoming of the LGBT community, politically active, and respective of other faiths and ideologies. And if you read that, you know, you can see how it's very, very easy for me to be a Unitarian, because the values are pretty much identical. And I found this quote on something from a, they're good at getting money out of people, the various Jewish communities. Matter of fact, a joke. This is Shipwreck, and these two guys are on this desert island in the middle of nowhere, and they're trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen to us. And one says to the other, you know, we're lost, you know. We're going to die here. They'll never find us. And the other one says, well, I'm not so sure. You know, I gave a pledge to the American Jewish Committee. They'll find me. as far as I know, that's a true story. So, this is the Israeli, we had a presentation from the Israel Reform Action Committee, okay? Their main mission is to make Judaism more accessible to Israeli Jews. Now, there are five key issues, okay? First is dismantling the Orthodox monopoly on promulgating policy for public transportation on Shabbat. Shabbat is the Jewish Sabbath, and the buses and trains and any kind of public transportation does not run on Shabbat. And this is, you need to understand that Israel, especially Tel Aviv, is a modern, thriving city, you know, and doesn't have any public transportation on those days. Well, that's that makes the ultra-Orthodox happy and keeps them in the government. Second of the issues is the equality of government funding. Presently, the Orthodox receive $60 million, Reform get $6 million. And so you have a disparity there. The $60 million that the ultra-Orthodox get provides a lot of their support, you know? I, frankly, don't like it. I think nobody owes anybody a living. I think you have to make your own living. And many of the Orthodox, the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel and in this country, the same kind of thing. Many of them don't make a living and rely on charity. Okay, health and safety, I'm not sure what that means. Struggle against racism. There's a good deal of racism by the ultra-Orthodox and much less I wouldn't say none, but much less from the Reform Jews. And five, remove gender discrimination in varied aspects of life. So this gender discrimination, which will appeal to many Unitarian Universalists in terms of something that needs to be stopped. And this country has made good progress. The problem is not over yet, but has made good progress in this. And give you an idea of how it works. Gender discrimination on public buses, when they're running, which is not on Shabbat, the women have to sit in the back. And often there's a physical partition between them, a curtain or something like that. Okay, women have to sit in the back. The Israeli Defense Forces, okay, the army, a woman officer, and they have women serving in the army. As a matter of fact, when the non-ultra-Orthodox Jews, when they're 18, they are obliged to provide 3 years of military service for the boys and 2 years of military service for the girls. And you have enlisted men and women, and men and women who are officers. Well, a woman officer cannot dine with the men officers. the problem is compounded by the fact that enlisted men, the women can't dine with the enlisted men either. So how do you get? I guess you have to take your own lunch. Higher education, women and men are in the same classroom, that's okay, but there has to be, the women have to lean back and there has to be a physical separation between them. With regard to religious services, women can't stand with men at a graveside. That's taboo. So there's a grassroots movement called Women of the Wall. You can Google this and read about it in more detail, but these are some women who are asserting their right to pray at the Western Wall. The Western Wall is the last remaining wall of the Second Temple, which was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans. Okay, it's considered one of the holiest sites, and the women want. Traditionally, it's been for men only. And women have been spurned, but they want a place, and many people think they should have it. The government has this situation of trying to please everybody, as most politicians do. They hired an architect, and the architect made a plan with the north side of the Western Wall, where men can pray, and the south side where women can pray. And there's a physical barrier between them. No action on that yet. It's difficult for the government to please all people. So what they're doing is they're studying it and studying it and studying it and not doing anything about it. Sound familiar? Okay. So removing gender discrimination is. One of their key focuses, or foci. All right. I want to publicly thank Casey for getting all these graphics. Guy's good. Okay, there's another slide. Of course, other information. If you look at the ethnicity. Of the Israelis, and the Israelis, that includes the Jews and the Arabs and the Christians and others. Israeli Arabs are citizens, but not so the Palestinian Arabs. Jews and Arabs tend to live in separate cities. There are, for the most part, like 90% Jewish or 90% Arab. There are five mixed cities where you have kind of equal amounts of all. And we visited one, it's called Lod, L-O-D. That's one of the five cities. It turns out that more Arabs are moving into Jewish communities because there's a better quality of life and there's a shortage of housing for Arabs. And sometimes they don't get along. And I think of Rodney King. Remember Rodney King?
Yeah.
Okay. And what he said was, why can't we all just get along with each other, you know? And that's the problem. Very often they don't. So there are efforts to facilitate getting along with one another. They have a mission-driven student village, have university students running the program, and they develop community centers where Jews, Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs can get to know each other. And that idea is spreading. The Israeli health system presents itself as a model for Jewish-Arab coexistence. Arabs, of course, include Muslims and Christians. And everybody in the healthcare system, the doctors and the nurses and the pharmacists, everybody agrees that on the basic principle of healthcare, that is, a wounded person is a wounded person and should be treated, regardless of their political or geographical affiliation. And that's also the code of the Israeli Defense Force, and it's the code of most doctors. All I know about the Hippocratic Oath is the beginning where it says, don't do any harm, but there's probably something in there that says, treat people, regardless of whether you like them or not. And in this format, the health system, all workers are sensitive to the other groups. Okay, Muslims don't attend events where there's alcohol served, and a prayer room is provided for them. There are cultural sensitivity classes that are provided, and the name tags that people wear are in Hebrew and Arabic and English. The hospital staff made a banner, Jews and Arabs refuse to be enemies. And so they're promoting the healthcare system as a model for Israeli Jewish and Israeli Arabs. Now, here's where it gets interesting. This is Israel. Well, it's a map of Israel. But you probably knew that. Okay. What I want to do is deal with the third conflict, and that's between the Israeli, between Israeli and Palestinians. Okay. So the root of the problem is you have conflicting narratives. Whose land is it? The Jews say one thing, the Palestinians say another. Briefly, the history of the Jews in Israel. Biblical times, you know, the Jews were in Palestine. Well, they were in Israel. They were banned from that area in 70 A.D. The Romans booted them out, and that was the beginning of the diaspora. You know, they went everywhere. And in 1897, Theodor Herzl had this idea of Zionism, where Jews needed a homeland. This is, 60 years before the Holocaust. And so the Jews bought land from the Arabs, mostly absentee landlords, and they got the land at a very good price because they didn't think they could do anything with it, you know? But the pioneers, the Israeli pioneers, came in. They drained the swamps, literally. They drained the swamps, and they developed irrigation, and they developed terrace farming, where you have a mountain, you know, and you do that, and you plant the stuff on the horizontal. Okay, so they developed land, and the desert was blooming for the first time, perhaps ever. World War I comes along, and Palestine had been... Oh, by the way, Palestine, the name Palestine was given to that area by the Romans, who had to call it something, and it was... Palestine was close to Philistine, so somehow they got Palestine from Philistine. Anyway, the Ottomans controlled this, that area for 400 years. World War I's over, the Ottoman Empire was defeated. The British were given a mandate by the League of Nations. And then came the Balfour Declaration. Balfour was in the House of Lords, and the Balfour Declaration stated something like, it's His Majesty's government, or Her Majesty's government, views with favor the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, which is what that area was called then. Included in there, and which is not mentioned very often, is in the Balfour Declaration, Balfour was saying that the Arabs' rights should be respected. It wasn't all one-sided. Balfour was cognizant of the strife between them. So the Brits came up with the Balfour Declaration, but then they realized that they needed oil, and so they backtracked. They issued what's called a white paper, which tried to negate the Balfour Declaration. And the Arabs were not happy with it, and the Jews were not happy with it, and so the Brits gave it to the United Nations. They dumped on it, here, you solve it, we can't do it anymore. And in 1947, the United Nations partitioned what we call Palestine into two states. And the two states, the yellow, represents what was given to the Jews. On the white part that's within the yellow, which we call the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, that was given to the Arabs, including the Gaza Strip, which is down there in the lower, in the south, southeast corner. And that was presented to the Jews and the Arabs, and the Jews said okay, and the Arabs didn't want it. They wanted the whole thing. So what would happen? Well, the Jews decided in 1948 to declare their independence. The next day, five Arab armies invaded, and surprisingly enough, they were defeated. The Arabs left. Now, the Arab armies left. Now, the indigenous Arab population, and there was an indigenous population, and still is, okay? Many of them left. Why? There are three stories. I don't know if they're all true. I don't know if none of them are true. And I don't know to which extent they are true. One is that some Arab, some of the indigenous population was encouraged by the Arabs. They said, hey, don't worry, we'll take care of the Jews and you can come and have their houses, which I guess were better, okay? Some stories say that they left at their own accord. And some stories say that the Israelis booted them out. I don't know what's true, probably all of them. Most of them went to Jordan and into refugee camps, but many stayed, okay? Then comes 1967, Six-Day War. Here's Nasser. The way you get elected in the Mideast, not in Israel, of course, but is you say, death to the Jews. Let's kill all the Jews, kill all the Zionists. And that's the way you get elected, you know? So Nasser, Abdul Gamal Nasser, is the leader of the Egyptian people. This is what he was telling people and whipped them up into a state of frenzy. And then our friends, the Soviets, got the word to him that the Jews, the Israelis, were going to invade. And and they went out to the border, and they didn't see any Jewish armies there. But in spite of that, the indigenous Arab population was so excited about going to war and killing the Israelis, he couldn't back down. In the meantime, King Hussein, not the brightest light bulb, he made a pact with Nasser, and Hussein was the king of Jordan, which is to the east of Israel, and the pact was that if if the Egyptians were invaded, that Jordan would come into the fight. Of course, it was misinformation that the Russians gave. I mean, they were kind of behind the whole thing. So King Hussein made a pact with Nasser. He couldn't back down. And the long and short of the story is that the Arabs were defeated. Now, the West Bank was, as the spoils of war, was taken by the Israelis, okay, as was Gaza, as was the Golan Heights. That's up there in the blue, near there, which is a border with Syria, and Jerusalem, which had been kind of mixed, but this was very important to the Jews. It's in the Bible, Jerusalem is mentioned hundreds and hundreds of times. In Jewish ceremonies, even with secular Jews, at the end of the Passover Seder, the Passover celebrating the redemption from Israel, the last thing you'd say is next year in Jerusalem. It was always very much a part of Jewish culture, and now we have it. Now Jerusalem has just been in the news recently because the United States, under our president leadership, moved the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, really pissed off the Arabs big time. Anyway, there's huge expansion, and in the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, a lot of Jews went and they settled, and so you have these settlements, which are like little cities. They have houses and they have bowling alleys and movies and restaurants, and so you have many of these little settlements. Then 1973, the Yom Kippur War, Arabs were defeated again, and we ended up, the Israelis ended up making peace with Egypt, signed peace treaty, for which Anwar Sadat was assassinated. You know, the Arab street didn't really care for the idea of having a treaty with Israel. And then, so we had peace with Egypt, and then we had a peace treaty with Jordan, okay? So, you know, you're left with this thing, whose land is it, okay? The Jews say God gave it to them, and the United Nations gave it to them, and they settled it, and they fought it. And the Palestinians said, yeah, but we were here all that time. It's our country. And it's true, they had been there for generations and generations, hundreds of years. So, maybe the idea to solve this problem is a two-state solution. Been many attempts. 1947, that's what the United Nations suggested, but the Arabs spurned it. So, and since then, there was the Camp David agreements and the Oslo Accords. So, a two-state solution, which would seem to satisfy everybody, that may never happen. And I should also mention that 1967 war, King Hussein was phoned by Golda Meir and telling him, don't enter this war. This is not your war. Egypt was the main player in that. But he had already signed a pact, and so he felt obliged to do it. Besides, I think he thought it would be an easy romp. They always think about that, Israel, and they're always wrong. So, peace for land. The Jews will say the West Bank is needed for security, and I don't think you need to be a military genius to realize that when a country can be has at its narrowest point, that's beneath the second purple marker, it's about 7 miles. And I don't think you need to be a military genius to know that they can cut the country in two very quickly. The Golan Heights, that's the blue thing over there, the blue area. For decades, the Syrians had been shelling the kibbutzim, and with impunity. Well, the Jews took that, and they're not giving that back for also for defensive purposes. So what's going to happen? You know, the Jews have their story. The Arabs have their story. There's never been peace there before. I don't see that there will be peace in my lifetime or in my children's lifetime, because if the Arabs are intransigent, and they have been, you can't, what's that, it's a Carole King song, you can't argue with a man with a shotgun in his hand or something like that. Smackboard Jack, yeah. Yeah, so, thank you, Michael. Michael knows a lot about popular culture. So anyway, that's where it stands now. I don't see any hope. A lot of people have tried. It hasn't happened yet. I don't know if it ever will happen. But you've got two conflicting stories. And the Arabs have their case, you know? There are some things. If you're interested in this topic, these are some readings, and I'll have copies of those on the counter. YouTube, find anything on YouTube, you know, and just put in Orthodox Jews dancing, put in Zionism, put in conflict, various wars. I mean, there's hundreds of hours of things to watch on YouTube. There's a book called The Lemon Tree, which I read, written by Sandy Tolan, and it tells a story, a true story, about an Arab who had been dispossessed and wants to go back to his home, but there's a Jewish family living there now, and they've lived there for several decades. And this talks about, you know, shows the Arab side of things, and it's a good read. Then there's a book, My Promise Land, by Ari Shavit. This will give you a Jewish perspective. Then there's one I read very recently called Letters to My Palestinian Neighbors. And here's a guy who's living in Israel, and he overlooks a Palestinian community. And he's saying, I understand where you're coming from, okay, but you need to understand where we're coming from. And he's very conciliatory and very generous, I think. And what he's saying is we got to learn to get along with each other, like Rodney King suggested. So that's a good read, too. And then the last one, if you're interested in military history, 6 Days of War, which that's the 6 Day War, 1967, and that is... It was a brilliant military campaign, and it's very exciting. So that's what's going on in Israel in 2018. You know, I'm glad I went. I learned a lot. Visited the kibbutz. I saw young Israeli Jews engaging in Reform Judaism activities. You know, and have you ever been to an evangelical church? Where it's on a stage, and they have singers, and they have musicians of all sort, and there's a joyousness in the congregation. Well, it was the same thing here that I saw in outside of Tel Aviv, and I remember watching. I said, you know, if I had been exposed to something like this, I'd probably be more religious than I am now. It was just very appealing. So it was a good trip. I'm glad I went. I would be happy to entertain any questions. I'd even answer them. Mm-hmm. Michael.
How much of what is going on is sustained by the continued building of settlements on the West Bank, you know what I'm saying? It's like you keep poking the sore all the time, and not allowing the Arabs even to just get used to what's there, because you're already building something else.
Yeah.
And I read Jimmy Carter's book about that, Peace, Not Apartheid. I don't know if you read that.
I have.
About how they've gotten this network of roads and the Palestinians can't even cross them.
Yeah.
You know, so you're stuck within that little, I don't know, some little square or some little triangle of between the Israeli roads. They shoot you.
Yeah. I should mention that we went to what was called an illegal settlement. Let's just say it was the international community sees these settlements as illegal. But the Jews don't. They say, hey, this is our land. God promised us this land. Hard to argue with that, okay? And so they build these settlements, and it does not help the peace process because the Arabs think, you know, like the more settlements there are, the more difficult it's going to be. The Israelis are probably using it to increase their bargaining position, I assume. But it is definitely something that the Arabs are against, and many American presidents have said that we should stop that, you know. But, you know, the Jews are, they do what they want. Helene, did I answer your question, Michael?
Yeah, because I'm thinking like the Israelis, the Jews are not going to want to just give all that land back to the Arabs when there are millions or hundreds, at least thousands of Jews living there.
Yeah.
And so I think that interrupts the idea of the two-state solution.
It does. It does. And but you know, Gaza, about 8 or 9 years ago, was given to the Palestinians, and immediately they started shelling Israel, and they are governed by Hamas, I believe, and so there'll be problems. Yeah, I'm calling.
I'll defer to Carl. I don't know
if this is clear from what you presented, but the West Bank. The West Bank of the Jordan, so it's that big
yes.
chunk of land east of Jerusalem all the way into Jordan. And I don't know if you go back to that map, but Israel claimed, won it in the Six-Day War, so they claim it as their territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's the way it is, as far as the Jews are concerned.
But they also have a biblical claim. There was Judea and Samaria. This was the nation of Israel in the Bible goes from the Jordan River, which is the eastern border of Israel, to the Mediterranean. And so, you know, whose land is it? Well, it's debatable. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Between the Israeli Jews and the Israeli Arabs. Yes. I think there's hope there.
But they don't have separate schools then. They do integrate at the schools
in Israel. Yeah, in the mixed cities. The Israelis and the Palestinians, that's another story. Yes, ma'am.
Have you ever read the Covenant series by Brock and Brody?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. As I said in my beginning remarks, this came. I'm not a historian, you know. But I just don't know. Yes, sir.
8% is a very small portion of the country. It's so disproportionately strong. I know that there are a number of different parties, but the alignment on that, it just seems unimaginable to me that small, very dependent. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes no political sense.
How
would
they gain the control?
Yeah.
Because it's a base. If you have your base.
Yeah, I have a theory that the Orthodox Jews, the ultra-Orthodox, did not want to come to Israel, but they were enticed by the government. I think they just kind of made some special deals with them to let them take care of some of the religious rituals and gave them control over things like marriage and divorce and things of that sort. So
is this part of the resettlement following the Holocaust? I'm just trying to figure out how that actually gets.
Well, the Orthodox, as I know it, and I may be a little wrong here, but as I know it, the ultra-Orthodox came after the Holocaust, mostly from Poland and Ukraine. Yes, yes, I think so. As a matter of fact, you know, one of the reasons why you have Arab Holocaust deniers is the fact that the Holocaust having happened would be a reason for the establishment of Israel. Okay, one more question, anyone? Okay, thanks, and Mazel Tov.
Thank you, Ed. That was very interesting.
You're welcome.